Today, Becky Barnes is joining the podcast. She is a paleontologist from Bismarck, North Dakota, working for the state of North Dakota. Welcome, Becky.
Thank you for having me.
Becky, what are the important programs that you are involved with in your department?
Under the umbrella of the North Dakota Geological Survey, which is part of the Industrial Commission and the Department of Mineral Resources, but our little subdivision works with recovering fossils from across the state of North Dakota, creating exhibits in not just the State Museum in Bismarck, but in many, many museums across the state, as well as public outreach. We do a lot of tours. We do a lot of Skype sessions. We do talks and presentations. So we really try to bring the public into the realm of paleontology and try to foster more of a love or an appreciation of these resources that are non-renewable across the state and under their feet, things that they may not know are out there. And part of that includes our public fossil digs, which are run every summer. And those span from the northeastern corner of the state up by the Pembina Gorge and Walhalla, all the way down to the west southwestern corner of the state down by Marmoth and Bowman, and everywhere in between. So a combination of all those together keeps us pretty busy.
The search for fossils, it's something that I've always been keenly interested in. So towards the tail end of our conversation, I'd like to talk about how that can be done by people that are interested in it, how folks can volunteer to work with paleontologists in their own region. However, I'd like to get right to the matter of the KT zone, and I think it might be named something else now, but I think it's a very interesting reality around the planet.
So the what used to be known as the KT boundary, K for Cretaceous because C was already used, and then T for Tertiary, has been renamed the KPG, so PG is now the Paleogene. And it's just, terms are fluctuating throughout the field of geology and paleontology, so I tend to get caught off guard as well. So these little time zones and the names are changing, and if I'm not right up to date on some of the papers that are being published, then I get corrected and change my outlook as well. But that's all just part of the field. So the KT boundary, or the KPG boundary, this big extinction event is definitely a global thing. It's pretty cool, where you have this band of iridium, basically, that has encircled the globe. And iridium is an extraterrestrial element. It's more concentrated in extraterrestrial bodies like our meteorites and asteroids versus what's actually found on Earth itself. So having an extremely high concentrated band of this circling the globe tells us that something definitely happened. And then more locally, you have around this zone these shocked quartz, which have to do with an impact primer. And you have these spherules, which have to do with ejecta and superheating of different materials. So these quartz nodules and things that are located around this same iridium zone. It's pretty neat. And not all areas have all of the same concentration of stuff because you have different spots around the globe that are further away. So you're not going to have those same concentrations. So this KPG zone is not at the surface everywhere across the globe because you have different rates of erosion. Some areas, that section has been completely weathered away. Other zones, the erosion has not occurred as rapidly, and so your boundary could actually be tens to hundreds and potentially even thousands of feet below the ground, below your feet. So we're pretty lucky here in North Dakota, where we actually have this KG boundary at the surface. Down in the southwestern corner of the state, over by Mud Buttes, have a little section where scientists can climb up and actually measure and examine this layer. So we're pretty lucky here.
It's my understanding that artifacts below the zone include fossils of dinosaurs, certain living organisms that are not present on the top side surface of the zone. Is that correct?
That's correct. So at that zone, below the zone, you would have the last gasp of the dinosaurs that were wandering around at the time at the late Cretaceous. And then after that zone, there's really nothing. You have a total faunal changeover. You have crocodiles are becoming your main predator. They're filling the niche of the top predators. There were generalists, so they weren't as affected by the extinction event than the dinosaurs were. Dinosaurs were definitely specialists. They had specific foods that they were going after. They had specific habitats that they needed. And with that disrupted, their world collapsed. But your generalists, things that, you know, a crocodile doesn't care if it's eating a wildebeest or a zebra or a turtle, you know, depending on the teeth. So you have generalists that can or ride out that storm a little bit easier. Same thing with a lot of the fish and the turtles, your generalist lizards, and then some of your birds as well.
Is the extinction clearly marked? Are all of scientists focused on the impact theory?
It's kind of a combination of things. There was definitely an impact, but you had a number of other things that were going on at the same time as well. You had the Deccan Traps that were big volcanoes over in India that had been exploding for a very, very long time, spewing forth gases and toxic fumes and creating acid rain and just nastiness in a local area. But even with the explosion of Mount St. Helens, you could see that ash, just on that one explosion, that ash went worldwide. So you would have this massive eruption that's been going on for hundreds to thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. So that's not very good. That's not healthy. And then you had the advent of flowering plants. So you had a plant changeover. Your flora was changing, where you had these fruits that were appearing. Now, not grasses. Grasses didn't appear for quite a long time. So if you ever see a picture of a dinosaur eating grass, it's wrong. No grass. But you had this plant changeover. And so your food sources were changing, and creatures had to either adapt to these new food sources or go extinct. And they were doing both. So pretty much a combination between all three of these meant the death knell for the dinosaurs.
The location of the impact, that was off the Yucatan shoreline.
It's called the Chicxulub Crater.
You mentioned the special diet. Wasn't there recently some news out of Canada about a dinosaur's stomach contents?
A very picky eater. It's a creature called a nodosaur, related to the armored tank ankylosaurs that people are more familiar with. Now, ankylosaurs are those short, squat, armor-plated, spiky, club-tailed beasties. Nodosaur has a lot of that same armor and spikes and stuff, but it does not have the club tail. And yeah, this creature apparently was a rather picky eater. So it's a low-browsing animal. They're very short, close to the ground, so they couldn't reach up high into the trees. So your tall treetop canopy is off limits. But any of the plants that were growing along the forest floor, including you've got club mosses, you've got ferns, you have cycads, you have tons of low-growing plants that would be ripe for the picking. And this animal was very, very selective, based on its stomach contents, on what it was eating. So even there would have, say there would be five types of common ferns. Maybe it only decided to eat two types of these ferns, and maybe not even the most common ones. Yeah, who knows? Maybe they were just tasty.
So the contents of this dinosaur indicated a certain lifestyle or a place where the animal lived?
These animals tended, according to the fossil record, these animals tended to live further away from, say, flood zones or deltas or big marshy grounds where their heavy bodies and fairly compact feet would sink into the ground. So they're going to be living further away from that kind of an environment versus your Edmontosaurus, which is, we lovingly call it the Cretaceous cow. They were very large, plant-eating animals, but they had very broad, splayed feet, perfect for walking on marshy ground or shifting ground, kind of like how you see the widespread toes on camels or the widespread toes for caribou, so walking on sand or snow. And so these animals would be more suited to walking on your shifting marshy ground versus your nodosaurs and ankylosaurs, probably preferred a little bit drier of a habitat. And that tends to show up in the food source as well.
This specimen was retrieved in an area where there was a former sea.
Yeah, this is it's an example of what we call bloat and float. And so this animal, after it was done eating, something happened to it. We don't know what happened to it. But it was carried out to sea, where it drowned, bloated, floated, and then sank down to the bottom of the ocean, or bottom of the sea, where it was then covered with, we call it a marine snow. So it's this constant raining detritus that's coming down through the waters It could be dirt washed out to sea from land. It could be fish poop. It could be just a combination of any type of material that's just slowly raining down. And so it's this constant rain that would have covered this animal and just encased it in its final cocoon.
Becky, this is a family show, so let's avoid talking about dinosaur poop.
Don't like coprolites?
Okay, in our everyday life, we have opportunities to discover fossils, right?
We certainly do. In the odd, most strange places as well. When my husband and I had gone on vacation, he was rolling his eyes at me because I had gone into the bathroom and I was just staring at the walls because the walls were limestone and they were fossiliferous limestone. And they had brought in these beautiful just panels and they were filled with corals and all kinds of invertebrates. So, I mean, you can find fossils in decorative places, so tiling or wall panels, limestone, marble, although they may be a little bit distorted in the marble since it's a metamorphic rock. But you can find things in buildings. You can find things in your backyard. My backyard is littered with gravel pits from the Cannonball Sea, which is the last little bit of the Western Interior Seaway that used to split North America in two. And we find Campyloma, which is a snail, Liroplacodes, Viviparous, so all kinds of different snails. And I can't wait to just grab a bucket full of this gravel and wash it because I want to see if there's any shark teeth. It'd be pretty cool. So, depending on where you are, you're going to have a better chance at finding stuff. I grew up in the Fargo-Moorhead area, which is in the middle of the Red River Valley, and it is a terrible, terrible place to look for fossils. So if you're listening in from Moorhead, Minnesota, I'm so sorry. You're just not going to find anything. It's covered with mud and muck and clay and the residue of Lake Agassiz. And Lake Agassiz was only about 10,000 years ago or so. So with the last bit of the ice age, the glaciation that used to cover big chunks of North America. And Lake Agassiz was one last remaining lake that covered a chunk, which makes for great farmland, but terrible fossil finding. If you look for areas with a little bit more erosion, where you have rivers or lakes that are cutting down through your rock layers, you might have a better chance of finding something. So looking at erosional valleys or rivulets cutting through. We get lots of people coming in saying, "Oh, I found a bone in a river cut, and it was down 20 feet. It has to be a dinosaur because it was down so far." But dirt shifts very quickly. Soil shifts very quickly, and most of the time, the river cut things tend to be bison, some or a deer, something very recent. And now that could be an older bison, it could be a 500-year-old bison, it could be a 1,000-year-old bison, but you have this ground that's maybe not quite as old as you think it is. And rivers move. People don't think of rivers as being mobile, but rivers will shift across the plain as they're cutting through the rock, which is how you get oxbows and things too, where you have these old river channels. And they'll just move back and forth. And as it moves, it's depositing on one side and it's cutting away at the other side. So it really depends on what kind of habitat, what kind of environment you live around.
Last year, I was walking through the central part of Des Moines, Iowa, and I keep an eye out for fossils. And I came across, I think it's Principal Insurance had decorated some of their landscape with large blocks of sedimentary rock. So, I stopped and looked things over. One of the folks that worked in the building came out to get in her car, and I asked her, "Do you want to see some fossils?" And from some distance away, she said, "I don't like fossils."
It's not for everybody.
And off she drove. Yeah, the meandering rivers. I recently saw a chart of the Mississippi River, and in the lower Mississippi, where the terrain is more flat, the river just wandered countless times. The chart was an incredible thing to view, with probably hundreds of different courses that the Mississippi took. Folks can come on board and volunteer with paleontologists on digs. Is that true?
Yes. Every summer we have what we call our public fossil days. This summer, due to all the chaos that's been going around, we have reduced those to 3 digs. One of our dig sites needed a little bit of a rest. You can only work a spot for so long before you just need to let nature do its magic and do some erosion and rain, weathering. And so this year we have our Bismarck area dig, our Pembina Gorge dig, and our Medora dig. And each one of those, you can sign up if you're a public. In the public, you can sign up to help volunteer at these digs. We do have age requirements, though, on our full days. So say your day starts at 8 o'clock and ends around 4 or 5. You would have to be 15 years or older. And for our half days, we call them the family days. We try to keep them a little shorter, so we have a morning session and an afternoon session. And though for those, you would have to be 10 years and up. So we have different lengths of time for different age groups. And people are welcome to come out and dip their toes into the water of paleontology.
If I come, do I necessarily have to have the attire of Indiana Jones?
We actually discourage that. We have plenty of people who really get into the movie persona of paleontologists and archaeologists. So you see plenty of Indiana Jones and you see plenty of Alan Grant. But honestly, a good set of shoes, comfy pants, and whatever shirt you want to wear. Hat is usually pretty necessary, though. Hat is pretty good, be that a wide brim or a baseball cap or whatever.
What specimens are likely to be found in those 3 sites?
The 3 sites are completely different, which makes them kind of fun. Starting with our oldest one would be the Pembina Gorge up in the northeastern corner of the state. That is a site with sea monsters. And so for there, you would have mosasaurs, big marine reptiles that look kind of like Komodo dragons with flippers instead of feet. You would have giant squid. You have sea turtles. We would have plesiosaurs, so think like the Loch Ness Monster. Lots and lots and lots and lots of fish. And so you get all kinds of creatures there. But as this is the bottom of that western interior seaway, you have a very large area where this marine snow is coming down and covering these animals. And these animals aren't restricted by a mountain or a river or anything like that. So they have this entire area where they can move around in and die in. And so when these animals die, you may hit a hot spot where there's 5 mosasaurs in a row. Or you may dig for 5 days and not find anything. So some days you get a little bit of dry fishing at the sea monster site, but other times are absolutely fantastic.
Have you personally had a unique discovery at that site?
Well, we've pulled out 5 mosasaurs from the site so far, or partial skeletons. Now, when I say mosasaur or like we found 5, that does not mean the full skeleton. That means one animal or whatever's left of that animal. So paleontology, we liken to, it's a study of prehistoric life, but really it's a study of prehistoric roadkill, because it's everything that's left over after Mother Nature's done with it. You have modern day creatures, scavengers, who are reclaiming the carcasses of animals that have died. So if some you get roadkill or a cow tips over in a field or something, you have coyotes and crows and beetles and bacteria and all kinds of nature's cleanup crew that take care of that. And we had that same thing in the past, although the players were different. So instead of a coyote for a marine environment, maybe you would have little sharks or other little creatures that are coming through. And yeah, maybe instead of your beetles, you would have crabs. And so they would come through and take care of these carcasses. And so you're finding just partial skeletons. But we found mosasaurs. One of my favorite finds up there was probably a partial skeleton of a Hesperornis or Baptornis, one of these swimming birds. Kind of looked like a cross between a loon or a grebe, but did not have wings.
How large was it?
About 4 feet. They were the original big bird. They're pretty big.
So when I go out on the river this afternoon and do a little fishing, I don't have to worry about that rascal?
Not so much, no. It would have been terrible on land.
You have two other sites. What specimens are likely to be found at those two?
Our next oldest site would be the Bismarck Area Dig. That is the one site that we have in North Dakota right now that we're offering, where you can actually find dinosaur material. And this used to be an old bend in a river or some kind of an oxbow where creatures were floating in over an unknown amount of time, but it was definitely a long period of time. And so these animals would, again, bloat and float and kind of disarticulate and fall apart as they're wandering through the river. And there you're finding a high concentration of Edmontosaurus, our big duck-billed dinosaur. We find Triceratops. And we have found a couple of little elements from what we call our raptors. So we do not have Velociraptor, not in North America. Those live over in Mongolia. But we do have relatives in that category. And we find Dromaeosaurus, and we find Acaroraptor, and we found teeth of both of those animals there. And we've also found one hand bone off of one of those creatures. We don't know who it is yet.
They put the interstate through, could certainly have interrupted, dislodged, destroyed some fossil beds. Is that likely just because of the proximity to your dig in the Bismarck area? Is it close to a highway construction or an interstate?
No, we're actually in what would be a pasture. And we do get cows that go wandering through on occasion. The interstate is far to the north of where we're working. We call it the Bismarck Area Dig because Bismarck is the largest town close to that site, but it's still about a 45-minute drive out to the site. So it's southwest of Bismarck. But as far as road construction goes, there are plenty of times where fossils have been discovered. Sometimes they're recovered, sometimes they're not. It depends on if you have people on board that can identify what they're looking at or understand that what they're looking at is something different. That's actually how we got pulled out to a different site over by the Williston area. We were contacted by one of the oil companies out there, and they had been preparing an oil pad, and one of their heavy machinery operators saw something that was different. It looked like bone. And so, long story short, we went out, figured out what it was, and it was a bison antiquus, so a very ancient bison. And we recovered that and brought it back here. It's currently drying, and we'll eventually get it all cleaned up and prepared and hopefully brought back to be put on display in Williston.
How much of the body was retrieved?
For that animal, you were looking at from about mid-rib forward. So we have the skull, the neck, the chest, the shoulder blades, the front arms, and then part of the rib cage, and then it just stops.
How would it compare to a modern bison?
Compared with your modern bison, the bison antiquus would have been slightly larger, but not immensely so. We had another creature called bison latifrons, and that was a monster of an animal. But bison antiquus would not have been too terribly larger than your bison. The horn shape is slightly different, where your modern bison have their horns tightly curled up. Your bison antiquus had the horns that were a little bit more splayed.
Okay, now you have that third site. Where is that?
Our third site is in Medora, or just east of Medora. We actually have two sites over there. We have one site east of Medora and one site west of Medora. But the site that we're going to this year is a Paleocene site. So this is just after that KPG boundary. So we're working in and around the Sentinel Butte and Bullion Creek formations. And at this point in time, North Dakota looked more closely to, say, like the Louisiana bayous or the Everglades. So it was a very swampy, marshy environment. The particular site that we're working was rich in fish and salamanders and crocodiles and champsosaurs. Yeah, these three sites are available, although most of the spots have already been filled for this year. We do have a waiting list that you can get on through our website. We have a little waiting list and a dig notification list. So come the end of the year, say around November, December, we start planning the following year's digs and figure out what dates we're going to go out, figure out which sites we're going to visit, so people can kind of check their calendars and see what would work for them. And then come February is when we have our sign up.
Are there any birds or mammals that represent very, very old living birds and animals? Or are most of the birds and animal species about the same in terms of that chronological aging?
Chronologically, you would be, I mean, all of the birds that are alive today have gone their own separate ways and have specialized. So each is individual to their subgroup. But you have maybe birds with more ancestral or I don't want to say primitive, but like more simplified traits, early traits. So for instance, with your ratites, your big flightless birds like an ostrich or a rhea or an emu, maybe they don't have these specialized flight feathers that an eagle would have, but they're having these more plumaceous or rachis-like feathers, and so they're a little bit more simplified. And those are very similar to some of the feathered dinosaurs that have been discovered in the last decade or so. So more simplistic feathers instead of the specialized flight feathers. You also have, in a lot of your flying creatures today, they have special oil glands on the tips of their tails. So when you see birds preening themselves and they're running their beak over the back of their tail and they're running through their wing feathers and they're running through their tail feathers, they're actually coating those feathers with this oil, which helps make them waterproof. Some birds don't have this. So if you've ever seen a cormorant, which is a diving bird, so you get these flying diving birds that go diving into the water, they catch their fish, they come back up, and then they have to go sit on a log and they open up their wings because they don't have this gland. They are not waterproof. So they're having to adapt and so then they spread their wings out to dry and let the sun bake on them instead.
Yeah, the cormorant is very common to where I live around the river, and they are just so strikingly different than birds. And that particular behavior you just described has always been a mystery to me. I didn't know. They look like scarecrows sitting up in the trees.
We always say that the present is key to the past, and it's one of the reasons why we end up studying so many different modern creatures and modern skeletons, is because without that knowledge, we can't properly identify and figure out our skeletons and creatures from the past. So while behaviors aren't necessarily found in the fossil record, we have to do a lot of inferring based on just their anatomy, just on the bones. In the rare case, you'll find something with feathers or a skin imprint, but for the most part, you just have bones. And sometimes not even a full complete skeleton. Most of the time, not a full complete skeleton. So we have to do a lot of educated guesswork, and our views are constantly changing. One of the fun things about blending art and science together, so I have a very heavy art background as well, is seeing the shifting of how prehistoric life is presented to the public. And when dinosaurs were first drawn, they were these big lumbering creatures, big overgrown lizards, slow moving. And then as more and more of their anatomy was researched and compared with modern creatures, they realized these animals had a lot of bird-like traits. So then the paleo artists and paleontologists started reconstructing these creatures as a lot more active. They had a lot more palatability, maybe a lot more movement, and a lot more colorful as well. And then as you just keep increasing that knowledge, our view keeps changing. Now, that view isn't necessarily accurate all the way across the board, because dinosaurs are your modern-day monsters, and so they're in video games, they're in movies, they're all over the place, and some restorations are more accurate than others. But it's really fun seeing that combination of modern traits, modern colors that you would see in birds and reptiles being put over onto your dinosaurs and other prehistoric creatures.
As folks are driving across the state of North Dakota on I-94, is there something about the topography that's important to observe? Is there something about that topography that tells us about the ancient sea?
We do find We don't find a lot of the western interior seaway evidence sitting at the surface. For that, you usually have to dig. We do find evidence of the last glaciers that decided to bulldoze to North Dakota. And so you'll find the nice flat Red River Valley way over on the east where the Fargo-Moorhead is located. And as you're trundling along to the west across 94, you'll reach what is essentially beaches, it's kind of like beaches where you have these deposits of rock from your melting glaciers. So the glacier, as it's moving and it's growing, is picking up a ton of rocks and a ton of soil. And when it melts, it drops it. And so you come across these different areas or zones where the glacier started melting and then dropped a lot of what it was carrying. And so you can kind of see that if you have it pointed out and you kind of know what you're looking for. There are a number of good books out there as well as far as geology books for highway geology. And, you know, what do you see from the highway? What can you see as far as glacial features, or what can you see for erosional features? We hit the Missouri, the Coteau, in the middle portion where you've got the prairie potholes, and we were littered with all kinds of little potholes of lakes and ponds. And as you continue west, the road almost seems to drop out from under you. With the Theodore Roosevelt National Park, you have a lot of erosion that's taking place. It's kind of like the North Dakota Badlands. And you go from this prairie look to very colorful, rugged badlands off to the west. So we have a lot of variation here.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been just a delightful conversation.